This is John Carradine. You are about to hear the incredible account of the conspiracy to rule the world, as told by Gary Allen in the April 1969 issue of the magazine American Opinion. To every thoughtful American, the foreign policy of the United States has for the past three decades been a compounding mystery and concern. Administrations have come and gone like the Ides of March, but spring never arrives, leaving America's crusade against international Bolshevism a matter of mere words, frozen in the drifts of a subversive blizzard. As better than a third of the world has fallen to the communists, and our sons have died by the scores of thousands to fight no-win wars from Korea to Vietnam, Americans have puzzled over why taxi drivers can understand the threat of the international communist conspiracy, while the experts of the State Department cannot. But with the collective shrug of shoulders already overburdened with mounting taxes, installment payments, and juniors' tuition at Riot Tech, the average American chalks up such things as the massive credit sales of advanced computers, metals, or jet engines to the communist bloc as mere error or stupidity, and goes about his business with the fading hope that the next administration will somehow manage to bring to government as much common sense as that found in taxi drivers. Such hopes are doomed to disappointment, because most Americans are being kept totally ignorant of the conspiratorial organizations whose members have set the same leftist policies for the past 10 administrations. Clearly, these policymakers are not fools at all, but following carefully laid plans for our convergence with the Soviet Union as the base for a dictatorial government of the world. As long as the American public remains ignorant of this organized conspiracy, there are just two chances of reversing the catastrophic momentum of America's foreign policy, slim and none. Perhaps the nexus of this organized subversive effort in America is an establishment-level organization known as the Council on Foreign Relations, the secret and incredibly powerful CFR. One of the extremely infrequent articles concerning this council to appear in the national press was published in the Christian Science Monitor of September 1st, 1961. It began this way. On the west side of fashionable Park Avenue at 68th Street in New York City sit two handsome buildings across the way from each other. One is the Soviet Embassy to the United Nations. Directly opposite on the southwest corner is the Council on Foreign Relations, probably one of the most influential semi-public organizations in the field of foreign policy. It is doubtful that one American in 1,000 so much as recognizes the council's name, or that one in 10,000 can describe anything at all about its structure or purpose. Indicative of the CFR's power to maintain its anonymity is the fact that despite its having been operative at the highest levels for nearly 50 years, and having from the beginning counted among its members the foremost lions of the establishment, communications media, I discovered after poring over decades of volumes of the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature that only one magazine article on the CFR has ever appeared in a major national journal, and that in Harper's, hardly a mass circulation periodical. Similarly, only a handful of articles on the Council have appeared in the nation's great newspapers. Such anonymity at that level can hardly be a matter of mere chance. Had it not been for a small group of highly informed and concerned conservatives who have for years painstakingly combed and cross-referenced the meager materials available, the Council's power and influence would remain a total mystery to all except the insiders in control of the CFR. The popular encyclopedia on the CFR and its satellites remains former FBI agent Dan Smoot's Invisible Government. Much updating material and a list of members for 1966 obtained circuitously can be found in Phoebe Courtney's The CFR. As a result of recent attacks by these conservatives, the wall of secrecy this organization has built around itself has been greatly enforced. In the past, although little appeared in the press concerning the CFR, rosters of officers and members could sometimes be obtained by subterfuge, directly from the organization itself. In recent years, however, the Council's membership has become as closely guarded a secret as that of the staff of the conspiracy to which the CFR is ultimately responsible. What makes the secret organization so influential? No one who knows for certain will say. Christian Science Monitor, which is edited by a member of the CFR, did note in the article of September 1, 1961, that its roster contains names distinguished in the field of diplomacy, government, business, finance, science, labor, journalism, law, and education. What united so wide-ranging and disparate a membership is a passionate concern for the direction of American foreign policy. The CFR's passionate concern for the direction of American foreign policy has amounted to an attempt to make certain that policy continues marching leftwards toward world government. The CFR was criticized for precisely this by the Reese Committee, a special committee of the House of Representatives established in 1953 to investigate abuses by tax-free foundations. In the case of the Council on Foreign Relations, the committee found that its productions are not objective, but are directed overwhelmingly at promoting the globalism concept. Despite nearly incredible pressure to remain silent, the Reese Committee disclosed that the CFR has in fact come to be almost an employment agency for key areas of the United States government, no doubt carrying its internationalist bias with it. The investigation also showed that CFR's influence is so great that it has almost completely usurped the prescribed activities of the U.S. State Department. The Christian Science Monitor confirmed this conclusion as follows. Because of the Council's single-minded dedication to studying and deliberating American foreign policy, there is a constant flow of its members from private to public service. Almost half of the Council members have been invited to assume official government positions or to act as consultants at one time or another. The policies promoted by the CFR in the fields of defense and international relations become the official policies of the United States government, with a regularity which defies the laws of chance. As liberal columnist Joseph Kraft, himself a member of the CFR, noted of the Council in Harper's of July 1958, "It has been the seat of basic government decisions, has set the context for many more, and has repeatedly served as a recruiting ground for ranking officials." Kraft, incidentally, aptly titled his article on the CFR, "School for Statesmen," an admission that the members of the Council are drilled with a line of strategy to be carried out in Washington. It thus becomes clear that the best way to begin to understand what have seemed to be our insane defense and foreign policies is to take a long, hard look at the organization which has provided the key staff and direction for those policies. But one cannot, of course, understand the CFR without first becoming aware of its background and antecedents. No group becomes so powerful by chance, and the roots go deep into conspiracy. Until quite recently, the origins of the CFR have largely seemed, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. The man who let the skunk out of the sack is Carol Quigley, professor of international relations at Georgetown University, who has been a lecturer at the Industrial College of the Armed Forces since 1951, and has lectured at the Foreign Service Institute of the State Department. Every student of the international communist conspiracy and of the insiders who manipulate it will want to own a copy of the professor's book, Tragedy and Hope, which provides an immense amount of new information on the subject not available from other sources. What makes Professor Quigley's volume doubly interesting is that the professor, who was allowed access to hitherto secret materials of certain clandestine establishment organizations, is the liberal who, while presenting abundant evidence exposing the elitist seeking control of the world through a super-government, does not himself oppose the conspiracy. In fact, he makes it abundantly clear that he approves the aims of the insiders and scorns those foolish enough to oppose them. Lest the products of the professor's enlightening research, which I shall subsequently review at length, cause anyone to think Professor Quigley to be some sort of an ivy-festooned avatar of Dan Smoot, let me reassure my liberal readers by citing a few of his characterizations of American conservatives. On the whole, the neo-isolationist discontent was a revolt of the ignorant against the informed or educated, of the 19th century against the insoluble problems of the 20th, of the Midwest of Tom Sawyer against the cosmopolitan East of J.P. Morgan and Company, of old Siwash against Harvard, of the Chicago Tribune against the Washington Post or New York Times, of simple absolutes against complex relativisms, of immediate final solutions against long-range partial alleviations, of frontier activism against European thought, unquote. Carol Quigley goes so far as to ridicule conservatives as racist, petty bourgeois hysterics defending middle-class morality. He writes, and I quote, "The virulence behind the Goldwater campaign had nothing to do with default or lack of intensity. Quite the contrary. His most ardent supporters were of the extremist petty bourgeois mentality driven to near hysteria by the disintegration of the middle classes and the steady rise in prominence of everything they considered anathema. Catholics, Negroes, immigrants, intellectuals, aristocrats and near-aristocrats, scientists and educated men generally, people from big cities or from the East, cosmopolitans and internationalists, and above all, liberals who accept diversity as a virtue." Unquote. It is clear from his writings that Professor Quigley considers himself no conservative, but one of the elitist aristocrats, forgive me, or near-aristocrats, destined to eliminate the middle classes and rule the world. It is this colossal smirking gall which makes the inflammation in his book even more illuminating and frightening. Obviously a creature of gargantuan ego, talking out of school to inform the world about how clever he is to know the way the world is really run, the professor commits the most damning confession against interest to come out of the establishment in decades. Quigley traces the lineage of the CFR back to Cecil Rhodes, the English adventurer who amassed a fortune in the gold and diamond mines of South Africa. While he follows the conspiracy of the insiders back no farther than Rhodes, he does indicate that it did not begin even there. And he notes that the man who bent Rhodes as a collegiate twig at Oxford was the notorious John Ruskin, noting of the conspiracy Ruskin called the New Imperialism. The chief changes were that it was justified on grounds of social reform and not, as earlier, on grounds of missionary activity and material advantage. Ruskin beguiled his students with tales of England's downtrodden masses, did his best to fill his aristocratic charges with a sense of profound guilt, convincing them that their privileged position could not be preserved unless their power could be extended to the lower classes in England itself and to the non-English masses throughout the world. So smitten with Ruskin's initial lecture was Rhodes that he copied it in longhand and kept it with him for 30 years. Ruskin's ideas about using noblesse oblige as justification for the imperialism of the insiders were used to rationalize political activities aimed at capturing the immense wealth of South Africa for Rhodes and the financiers and conspirators who were his backers. The indoctrination by Ruskin was thus turned into an instrument of conquest by Rhodes, on what we are asked to believe was the assumption, according to biographers, Lockhart and Woodhouse, that God had chosen Cecil Rhodes to paint the map of Africa red. Rhodes' biographer, Sarah Millen, was a little more direct. As she put it, the government of the world was Rhodes' simple desire. Quigley notes, and I quote, "In the middle of 1890s, Rhodes had a personal income of at least £1 million sterling a year, then about $5 million. Which he spent so freely for his mysterious purposes that he was usually overdrawn on his account. These purposes centered on his desire to federate the English-speaking peoples and to bring all the inhabitable portions of the world under their control." Cecil Rhodes' commitment to a conspiracy to establish world government was set down in a series of wills described by Frank Edelot, a founding member of the CFR and American secretary to the Rhodes trustees, in his book, American Rhodes Scholarships. Edelot writes, "The seven wills which Cecil Rhodes made between the ages of 24 and 46, Rhodes died at age 48, constitute a kind of spiritual autobiography. Best known are the first, the Secret Society will, and the last, which established the Rhodes Scholarships. In his first will, Rhodes states his aims still more specifically, the extension of British rule throughout the world, the foundation of so great a power as to hereafter render wars impossible and promote the interests of humanity. The confession of faith enlarges upon these ideas. The model for this proposed secret society was the Society of Jesus, though he mentions also the Masons. It should be noted that the originator on the profane level of this type of secret society was Adam Weishaupt, the monster who founded the Order of Illuminati on May the 1st, 1776, for the purpose of conspiracy to control the world. The role of Weishaupt's Illuminists in such horrors as the Reign of Terror is unquestioned, and the techniques of the Illuminati have long been recognized as models for communist methodology. Weishaupt also used the structure of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, as his model, and rewrote his code in Masonic terms. Adelot continues. In 1888, Rhodes made his third will, leaving everything to Lord Rothschild, his financier in mining enterprises, with an accompanying letter enclosing the written matter discussed between us. This one surmises consisted of the first will and the confession of faith, since in the postscript Rhodes says, in considering questions suggested, take constitution of the Jesuits if obtainable. Apparently for strategic reasons, Lord Rothschild was subsequently removed from the forefront of the scheme. Professor Quigley reveals that Lord Rosebery replaced his father-in-law, Lord Rothschild, in Rhodes' secret group and was made a trustee under Rhodes' next and last will. The last will of Cecil Rhodes provides for bringing Rhodes scholars from the Empire, Germany, and America for schooling in internationalism at Oxford. The plan, according to Rhodes' fellow conspirator, William Stead, was that after 30 years there would be between 2,000 and 3,000 men in the prime of life scattered all over the world, each one of whom would have impressed upon his mind in the most susceptible period of his life the dream of the founder, each one of whom, moreover, would have been specially, mathematically selected towards the founder's purposes, world government. Biographer Sarah Millen writes of the qualifications for becoming part of this cadre. In speaking of these attributes, desirable in Rhodes scholars, to Stead, Rhodes defined them with that defensive cynicism of the Romantic as smugness, brutality, unctuous rectitude, and tact. At the very time the Rhodes Trust began to filter its scholars into Oxford, the university was, of course, coming under the academic domination of the members of the Fabian Socialist Society, providing the Rhodes scholars not only with the intended indoctrination and preparation to become part of an international government, but part of an international socialist government. Quigley informs us approvingly that it was the aim of the Rhodes Group to promote the economic doctrines taught in the London School of Economics. He does not mention, however, that the London School of Economics was established by the Fabians to teach the economics of international socialism. In fact, Professor Quigley is very careful to avoid so much as the mention of the Fabian movement. At first glance, it would appear that the Fabians were working at cross purposes with the Rhodes conspiracy, since Rhodes is said by his admirers to have wanted to extend the British Empire to encompass the entire world, while the Fabians wished to dissolve that empire into an international socialist utopia. Yet the strategy of using Fabian socialism clearly fits. Times were changing, and a more subtle and devious approach was necessary to accomplish Rhodes' dream of world government. The new ideology was doubtless provided by the Fabians. Those who doubt it have only to note the well-known influence of the Fabians on those organizations cited by author Frank Adelot when he proclaims that the carefully indoctrinated Rhodes scholars from America, I quote, have taken a prominent part in the work of such organizations as the Council on Foreign Relations, the National Policy Committee, the League of Nations Association, Union Now, the United Nations Association, the Commission for the Study of Organization of Peace, the University's Committee on Post-War International Problems, the Institute of Pacific Relations, the World Peace Foundations, and the research group attached to the State Department, unquote. Note that all are both Fabian-oriented and working for world government. More distressing, Adelot concludes, the number of those going into government is constantly increasing. What happens to Americans passing through the Rhodes indoctrination at Oxford? Frank Adelot assures us, if he have seek the capacity for assimilation, if he can become a part of what he meets, he may return from Oxford to the United States, a citizen of the world. And there can be little doubt of it. Some of the Rhodes alumni, to wear the old school tie in our government, are Dean Rusk, Walter Whitman Rostow, Senator J. William Fulbright, Harlan Cleveland, Nicholas Katzenbach, and Senator Frank Church, all members of the CFR. René Wormser, who served as counsel for the Reese Committee, points out in his book, Foundations, Their Power and Influence, that, and I quote, at least one foreign foundation, the Rhodes Scholarship Fund, has had a strong influence on our foreign policy. It has gained great influence in the United States for British or Fabian ideas. It has accomplished this by annually selecting a choice group of promising young men for study in England. The usually Anglophile alumni of this system are to be found in eminent positions in legislature, administration, and education, and in the ranks of American foundation officials. They form a patronage network of considerable importance. That is very nearly the understatement of the decade. The scholarship scheme was not, however, the most important segment of Cecil Rhodes' commitment to world government. His Illuminist-style secret society also spawned the world's most influential foreign policy combine, including America's Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Quigley writes of the formalization of Rhodes' secret society, and I quote, they, that is Ruskin's disciples, were remarkably successful in these aims because England's most sensational journalist, William T. Stead, an ardent social reformer and imperialist, brought them into association with Rhodes. This association was formally established on February the 5th, 1891, when Rhodes and Stead organized a secret society of which Rhodes had been dreaming for 16 years. In this secret society, Rhodes was to be leader. Stead, Brett, that is Lord Esher, and Alfred Milner were to form an executive committee. Arthur Lord Balfour, Sir Harry Johnston, Lord Rothschild, Albert Lord Grey, and others were listed as potential members of a circle of initiates, while there was to be an outer circle known as the Association of Helpers, later organized by Milner as the Round Table Organization. Notice that the secret society was organized on the Illuminist pattern of circles within circles, used in Bavaria and France by Weishaupt, and that the Round Table group, which was later to spawn the Council on Foreign Relations, was not part of the inner circle. Professor Carroll Quigley continues as follows. Thus, the central part of the secret society was established by March 1891. It continued to function as a formal group, although the outer circle was apparently not organized until 1901 to 1913. This group was able to get access to Rhodes' money after his death in 1902, and also to the fund of loyal Rhodes supporters like Alfred Beit, a German financier from Frankfurt, and partner of Rhodes, and Sir Abe Bailey. Later, financing was to come from the Astor family, and according to Quigley, since 1925 there had been substantial contributions from wealthy individuals and from foundations and firms associated with the international banking fraternity, especially the Andrew Carnegie United Kingdom Trust and other organizations associated with J.P. Morgan, the Rockefeller and Whitney families, and the associates of Lazard Brothers and of Morgan, Grenfell and Company. The chief backbone of this organization grew up along the already existing financial cooperation running from the Morgan Bank in New York to a group of international financiers in London, led by Lazard Brothers. Why would international bankers and financiers be interested in promoting a socialist world government? Clearly, socialism is only the bait to obtain the support of the political underworld and to create the structure necessary to maintain dictatorial control. What this small group of financiers and cartel-oriented businessmen are interested in is monopoly control over the world's natural resources, trade, transportation, and communications, something that, despite their great wealth, they could not achieve otherwise. Therefore, the super-capitalists become super-socialists, realizing that only a world government under their control can give them the power necessary to achieve their goal. Only this could explain why these extremely wealthy men would be willing to support movements which seem to be aimed at their own destruction. The financiers and cartelists do not expect to be injured by the socialists, so long as they can manipulate them, using them for their own purposes. Professor Quigley confirms this, and I quote, there does exist and has existed for a generation an international network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Round Table Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does so. This clearly suggests that the directors of the network are convinced that they have little to fear from the communists, that in fact they maintain some form or degree of inside control over the communists. Quigley's attitude toward this conspiracy and his sources of information are revealed in the following statement. I know of the operations of this network because I've studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have for most of my life been close to it and to many of its instruments. I have objected both in the past and recently to a few of its policies, but in general my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known. To the insiders of the Round Table, world government is a messianic cause. As Lionel Curtis, a member of the Round Table, phrased it, through world federation, quote, the kingdom of God could be established on earth, unquote. According to his obituary written for his fellow members of the Round Table, Lord Lothian, who entered his career as ambassador to the United States, held that men should strive to build the kingdom of heaven here upon this earth, and that the leadership in that task must fall first and foremost upon the English-speaking peoples. Leaders of this group of would-be gods have been, according to Quigley, Alfred Milner until his death in 1925, followed by Curtis, Robert H. Lord Brand, brother-in-law of Lady Astor until his death in 1963, and now Adam Masick, son of Sir William and Brand's successor as managing director of Lazard Brothers Bank. Professor Quigley maintains that the power and influence of the Rhodes-Milner Group since 1889, although not widely recognized, can hardly be exaggerated. For example, the Round Table Group controlled the London Times and numerous other newspapers and periodicals on six continents, and also influenced literally hundreds of university faculties. Quigley discloses, from 1884 to about 1915, members of this group worked valiantly to extend the empire and to organize it into a federal system. They were constantly harping on the lessons to be learned from the British failure of the American Revolution and the success of the Canadian Federation of 1867, and hoped to federate the various parts of the empire as seemed feasible, then confederate the whole of it with the United Kingdom into a single organization. They also hoped to bring the United States into this organization to whatever degree was possible. Stead was able to get Rhodes to accept in principle a solution which might have made Washington the capital of the whole organization, or allow parts of the empire to become states of the American Union. A loosely organized corps of the Round Table Conspirators was thus formed in the United States prior to World War I. The chief personalities were George Beer, Walter Lippmann, Frank Adelot, Whitney Shepherdson, Thomas Lamont, Jerome Green, and Irwin Cannon. This group's activities were coordinated with those of similar groups throughout the British Empire by frequent visits and discussions, and by a totally anonymous quarterly magazine, The Round Table. It was in the aftermath of World War I, however, that the Round Table conspiracy made its move for power and influence in America. According to Professor Quigley, and I quote, at the end of the war of 1914, it became clear that the organization of this system, the Round Table Group, had to be greatly extended. Once again, the task was entrusted to Lionel Curtis, who established in England and each dominion a front organization to the existing Round Table Group. This front organization, called the Royal Institute of International Affairs, had as its nucleus in each area the existing submerged Round Table Group. In New York, it was known as the Council on Foreign Relations, and was a front for J.P. Morgan and Company in association with a very small American Round Table Group. The American organizers were dominated by the large number of Morgan experts, including Lamont and Beer, who had gone to the Paris Peace Conference and there became close friends with a similar group of English experts, which had been recruited by the Milner Group. In fact, the original plans for the Royal Institute of International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations were drawn up at Paris. The Council of RIIA, which by Curtis Energy came to be housed in Chatham House across St. James Square from the Astors, and was soon known by the name of this headquarters, and the board of the Council on Foreign Relations had carried ever since the marks of their origin. Although Professor Quigley's information is extremely revealing, it is amazing to note that he has very carefully omitted the name of one of the stars of the founding of the CFR, the mysterious Colonel Edward Mandel House. This could hardly have been a mere oversight. For whatever reason, Professor Quigley thought House best left out of his discussions. Joseph Kraft of the CFR, however, tells us in Harper's that the chief agent in the formal founding of the CFR was Colonel House, supported by such of his protégés as Walter Lippmann, CFR, John Foster Dulles, CFR, Alan Dulles, CFR, and Christian Herter, CFR. It was House who acted as host for the roundtable group, both English and American, at the key meeting of May 19, 1919, in the Majestic Hotel, Paris, which committed the conspiracy to creation of the CFR. The conspirators had hoped to establish a world government under the League of Nations as an outgrowth of World War I. But while President Woodrow Wilson House, the man he called his alter ego, were doing their best to restructure the world at Versailles, the ether of internationalist propaganda was rapidly wearing off back home. As the negotiations revealed that one side had been about as guilty as the other, and all the glitter of the moral crusade evaporated with Wilson's mounted 14 points, the rubes back on Main Street began to stir and awaken. Reaction and disillusionment set in. Americans hardly wanted to get into a world government with double-dealing European crooks, whose specialty was secret treaty hidden behind secret treaty. The guest of honor, so to speak, stalked out of the banquet before the poisoned meat could be served. And without American inclusion, there could be no meaningful world government. Aroused public opinion made it obvious that the United States Senate dare not ratify a treaty saddling this country with such an internationalist commitment. The American public had to somehow be sold the idea of internationalism and world government, and the CFR was made to order for precisely that purpose. Again, the key was Colonel House. The significance of the hands of House in the construction of the Council on Foreign Relations can only be understood against his background as an agent for the insiders. House, whose father was a representative in the American South for English financial interests, was Texas-born but educated in England. He was a long-time intriguer in Democratic politics and had been instrumental in electing several governors of Texas, one of whom gave him the honorary title of Colonel. His move into national politics came with his early backing of Woodrow Wilson, who regarded him as his political mentor and relied heavily upon him. House was described by a friend of 25 years standing as highly radical, more than liberal in the political social sense. The Colonel was strictly a behind-the-scenes operator who never had any official capacity, but who gained intense satisfaction as a master of the marionettes who occupied the center stage. His personal political philosophy was detailed in a prophetic novel entitled Philip Drew, Administrator, published by B.W. Hoitsch, a favorite of the left and for many years a prominent Fabian. The book was so loaded with political dynamite that no author was listed, but in private letters to friends, House admitted authorship. In Philip Drew, Edward House had laid out a thinly fictionalized plan for conquest of America. He described a conspiracy, the word is his, which succeeds in electing United States president by means of deception regarding his real opinions and intentions. Although partially thwarted by the loss of Wilson to illness, House succeeded in 1932 with FDR, who went straight from the Chicago Convention to huddle with the Colonel at the latter's Massachusetts home. In 1938, House told his biographer, Charles Seymour, "During the last 15 years, I've been close to the center of things, although few people suspect it. No important foreigner has come to America without talking to me. I was close to the movement that nominated Roosevelt. He has given me free hand in advising Secretary of State Cordell Hull. All the ambassadors have reported to me frequently." Among other things, wrote the CFR founder, the conspiracy was to insinuate itself into the primaries in order that no candidate might be nominated whose views were not in accord with theirs. Elections were to become mere charades, conducted for the bedazzlement of the bourgeoisie. The idea was to use both the Democrat and Republican parties as instruments to promote world government. House's outline for conspiracy is given excellent analysis by his fawning biographer, Professor Charles Seymour of the CFR. Professor Seymour states in the intimate papers of Colonel House, and I quote, "The extent of Colonel House's influence upon the legislative plans of the Wilson administration may be gathered from a remarkable document which deserves some attention. In the autumn of 1912, immediately after the presidential election, there was published a novel or political romance entitled Philip Drew, Administrator. It was the story of a young West Point graduate who was caught by the spirit of revolt against the tyranny of privileged interests. A stupid and reactionary government at Washington provokes armed rebellion in which Drew joins wholeheartedly, and which he ultimately leads to complete success. He himself becomes dictator and proceeds by ordinance to remake the mechanism of government, to reform the basic laws that determine the relation of the classes, and to bring about an international grouping or league of powers founded upon Anglo-Saxon solidarity. His reforms accomplished, he gives effect once more to representative institutions as formulated in a new American constitution, better fitted than the old for the spirit and conditions of the 20th century. Much that House outlined in Philip Drew became reality during the Wilson administration. All that book has said should be comes about, wrote Wilson's Secretary of the Interior, Franklin K. Lane. The president comes to Philip Drew in the end. In Philip Drew, Edward House wrote of establishing socialism as dreamed by Karl Marx. A major step toward achievement of this was taken with the passage of the graduated income tax, a plank in the Communist Manifesto, the realization of which House called for in Philip Drew. Of course, House's patrons, who helped push the graduated income tax, deftly sidestepped its effect by placing major portions of their own fortunes under the umbrella of tax-free foundations. The idea, remember, is to destroy the middle class, not the wealthy. House also served the insiders by acting as what Professor Seymour calls the unseen guardian angel of the Federal Reserve Act. In his book, Colonel House had Drew decree just such a new banking law, providing a flexible paper currency. Again, placing the control of money and all credit in the hand of the state was another plank from the Communist Manifesto. The intimate papers of Colonel House reveals that the colonel was working hand in glove with certain Wall Street insiders to promote the Federal Reserve Act under the guise of its being a move toward democracy. Biographer George Bielek assures us that the ships, CFR, the Warbirds, CFR, the Can, CFR, the Rockefellers, CFR, and the Morgans, CFR, put their faith in House. Many patriotic bankers, of course, opposed the Federal Reserve and other socialist legislation imposed on America by the Wilson-House regime. But conspirators are interested in control, and in the end, control resides in the power to expand government. He who controls the reins of government controls the people. Control the government of the world, and you control the people of the world. Much of the control over the people of America was originally engineered by Colonel House, who by the time he acted as midwife at the birth of the CFR in Paris, was an experienced and successful frontman for the insiders. The CFR, as we have seen, was the brainchild of the Round Table Conspiracy, acting with and through Colonel House. Its purpose was to promote the concepts of internationalism and world government. This was to be accomplished largely by infiltration of the government and both political parties, a la Philip Drew. You will recall it was House's plan to manipulate this conspiracy in such a way that opposing candidates would only seem to have differences. And you may have noticed, today, national candidates argue only over providing new leadership, not new policies. The move toward world government has thus never so much as slowed. Key to this conspiracy in America has been the Round Table's Council on Foreign Relations. The CFR's 25th annual report tells us this of the CFR's founding at Paris. The Institute of International Affairs, founded at Paris in 1919, was comprised at the outset of two branches, one in the United Kingdom and one in the United States. Later, the plan was changed to create an ostensible autonomy because, quote, it seemed unwise to set up a single institute with branches, unquote. It had to be made to appear that the CFR in America and the RIIA in Britain were really independent bodies. Lest the American public become aware that the CFR was in fact a subsidiary of the Roundtable Group and react in patriotic fury. Professor Quigley provides a rundown on who was who in the CFR when it was finally incorporated in 1921. The New York branch of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, that is, the Council on Foreign Relations, was dominated by the associates of the Morgan Bank. For example, in 1928, the Council on Foreign Relations had John W. Davis as president, Paul Cravath as vice president, and the Council of 13 others, which included Owen D. Young, Russell C. Leffingwell, Norman Davis, Alan Dulles, George W. Wickersham, Frank P. Polk, Whitney Shepherdson, Isaiah Bowman, Stephen Duggan, and Otto Kahn, all of whom were partners, associates, or employees of Morgan interests. The academic figures had been those linked to Morgan, such as James T. Shotwell, Charles Seymour, House's biographer, Joseph Chamberlain, Philip Jessup, and more recently, Philip Moseley, Grayson Kirk, and Henry M. Wriston. Closely allied with this Morgan influence were a small group of Wall Street law firms, whose chief figures were Elihu Root, John W. Davis, Paul D. Cravath, Russell Leffingwell, the Dulles brothers, and more recently, Arthur H. Dean, Philip D. Reed, and John J. McCloy. According to Quigley, the most important financial dynasties in America during the 20s were, in addition to Morgan, the Rockefeller family, Kuhn, Loeb & Company, Dillon Road & Company, and Brown Brothers Harriman. All were well represented in the CFR, and by such luminaries as Otto Kahn, Jacob Schiff, Pincer Leon Trotsky and the Russian Revolution, Paul Warburg, Schiff's partner, architect of the Federal Reserve Act, and brother of Max Warburg, who financed the Russian Revolution from Germany, William Averill Harriman, Albert H. Wigan, Frank Vanderlip, and Herbert H. Lehman. In addition, the charter membership of the CFR was comprised of 150 members of Colonel House's select task force for planning the peace treaty, plus one of the founders of the Intercollegiate Socialist Society named Walter Lippmann. During the return to normalcy of the 20s, the CFR remained relatively quiet. In 1929, it acquired its headquarters property, the Harold Pratt House at 58 East 68th Street in New York, as a gift from the Rockefellers. Through the years, the Rockefeller clan has continued to support the CFR with generous grants from their tax-free foundations. Much of the Council's financing has come also from the various Carnegie foundations. There is, in fact, a great deal to indicate that Andrew Carnegie was neck-deep in the Rhodes Conspiracy. The two were very close friends, and Carnegie, who made millions in America, yet never became an American citizen, dreamed like Rhodes of reuniting of England and America. The Rees Committee, in its investigation of the foundations, discovered that the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace began propaganda activities for U.S. involvement in the European War several years before World War I began. The conspirators of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace were convinced that the best way to establish world peace was through a world war, which would lead to world government. The various Carnegie foundations were, and still are, heavily represented in the CFR membership. As World War II approached, the Roundtable Group was influenced in seeing that Hitler was not stopped in Austria, the Rhineland, or Sudetenland, and thereby was largely responsible for precipitating the Holocaust. A Second World War would greatly enhance the opportunity for establishment of world government. With the Roundtable doing its work in Europe, the CFR carried the ball in the United States. The Council's first task was to infiltrate and develop effective control of the U.S. State Department to make certain that after World War II, there would be no slip-ups as there had been following World War I. The story of the CFR takeover of the U.S. Department of State is contained in State Department Publication 2349, a report to the President on the results of the San Francisco Conference. It is the report of Secretary of State Edward R. Stettinius to President Harry Truman. On page 20 we find, quote, "With the outbreak of war in Europe, it was clear that the United States would be confronted after the war with new and exceptional problems. Accordingly, a committee on post-war problems was set up before the end of 1939, 2 years before the U.S. entered the war, at the suggestion of the CFR. The committee consisted of high officials of the Department of State, all but one of whom were CFR members. It was assisted by a research staff provided by, financed by, and directed by the CFR, which in February 1941 was organized into a division of special research and went off the CFR payroll and on to that of the State Department. After Pearl Harbor, the research facilities were rapidly expanded, and the Departmental Committee on Post-War Problems was reorganized into an advisory committee on post-war foreign policies, completely staffed by the CFR. The fact that a powerful CFR contingent was moved into the State Department in 1939 is verified in the CFR's booklet, A Record of 20 Years, 1921-47, which says of the financing for the takeover, quote, "The program here described was largely financed by generous annual renewals of an initial grant of funds by the Rockefeller Foundation late in 1939. In addition, an annual grant of the Carnegie Corporation contributed to the success of the work. This is the group which designed the United Nations, the first major successful step on the road to a world superstate. Members of the CFR group included Harold Stassen, John J. McCloy, Owen Lattimore, conscious articulate instrument of the Soviet international conspiracy, Alger Hiss, communist spy, Philip Jessup, Harry Dexter White, communist spy, Nelson Rockefeller, John Foster Dulles, John Carter Vincent, security risk, and Dean Acheson. 47 CFR members were among the American delegates to the founding of the UN in San Francisco in 1945. Not only did members of the Council on Foreign Relations dominate the establishment of the UN, but CFR members were at the elbow of the American president at Tehran, Potsdam, and Yalta, where hundreds of millions of human beings were delivered into the hands of Joseph Stalin, vastly extending the power of the international communist conspiracy. Administrative assistant to the President of the United States during this time was a key member of the CFR, named Lachlan Curry, subsequently identified by J. Edgar Hoover as a Soviet agent, and CFR IPR liaison to the President. So completely has the CFR dominated the State Department over the past 38 years that every Secretary of State except Cordell Hull, James Burns, and William Rogers has been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. While Rogers is not CFR, Professor Henry Kissinger, the President's chief foreign policy advisor, came to the job from the staff of the Council on Foreign Relations. It will be interesting to watch as Kissinger, not Rogers, runs America's foreign policy. Having ensured that Eastern Europe would fall into the hands of the communists, the CFR helped to arrange the sellout of China to the communists. The propaganda which convinced Americans that Mao Tse-tung was an innocent agrarian reformer running an Asian branch of the ADA emanated from a CFR front known as the Institute of Pacific Relations. Professor Quigley reveals, and I quote, "After 1925, a somewhat similar structure of organizations, known as the Institute of Pacific Relations, was set up in 12 countries on an interlocking basis with the Roundtable Group and the Royal Institute of International Affairs. The Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, which investigated the American branch, concluded, and I quote, the Institute of Pacific Relations, IPR, has been considered by the American Communist Party and by Soviet officials as an instrument of communist policy, propaganda, and military intelligence. The IPR disseminated and sought to popularize false information originating from Soviet and communist sources. Members of the small corps of officials and staff members who controlled IPR were either communist or pro-communist. The IPR was a vehicle used by the communists to orient American Far Eastern policies toward communist objectives." Unquote. Quigley, whom you will keep in mind, is biased in favor of the Round Table conspiracy, states, and I quote, "The influence of the communists in IPR is well established, but the patronage of Wall Street is less well known. The headquarters of the IPR and of the American Council of IPR were both in New York and were closely associated on an interlocking basis. Each spent about $2.5 million over the quarter century from 1925 to 1950, of which about half, in each case, came from the Carnegie Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, which were themselves interlocking groups controlled by an alliance of Morgan and Rockefeller interests in Wall Street. Much of the rest, especially of the American Council, came from firms closely allied to these two Wall Street interests, such as Standard Oil, International Telephone and Telegraph, International General Electric, the National City Bank, and the Chase National Bank. Since the English and American roundtable groups were financed by men who had extensive holdings in China, why would they not be doing everything in their power to make certain that China did not fall to the communists? This is what Alfred Kohlberg, a patriotic American who had investments in China, could not understand. Kohlberg was an IPR member who, when he discovered its communist domination, tried to fight the Rockefeller and Carnegie interests and expose the IPR. Through his efforts, the Institute of Pacific Relations was exposed by the McCarran Committee of the United States Senate, though the role of the CFR was kept out of the scandal. The fact of the matter is that the communist IPR was run by CFR stalwarts as Owen Lattimore, the conscious, articulate instrument of the Soviet conspiracy. Soviophile Philip Joseph, Dean Rusk, communist spies Alger Hiss and Lachlan Curry, and other such CFR notables. It is less than coincidence that the Council on Foreign Relations now advocates recognition of Red China, quote, "to pull China back into the family of nations." Whenever one points to the strange affinity between a coterie of finance capitalists and communism, one is treated as if he is a candidate for the funny farm. In spite of all the evidence in his own book, Professor Quigley, who describes the Eastern establishment as internationalist, astonishingly liberal, and admits the group has no aversion to cooperating with the communists, laughs at the idea that the two are linked. He does, however, admit, and I quote, "the relationship between the financial circles of London and those of the Eastern United States reflects one of the most powerful influences in 20th century American and world history. The two ends of this English-speaking axis have sometimes been called, perhaps facetiously, the English and American establishments. There is, however, a considerable degree of truth to the joke, a truth which reflects a very real power structure. It is this power structure which the radical right in the United States has been attacking for years in the belief that they are attacking the communists. This is particularly true when these attacks are directed, as they so frequently are, at Harvard Socialism or at left-wing newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, or at foundations." After describing how cosmopolitan and sophisticated these people are, the professor actually tries to rationalize communist activity in this establishment, conspiracy, as a product of naivete. Quigley writes, and I quote, "It was this group of people whose wealth and influence so exceeded their experience and understanding, Sikh, who provided much of the framework of influence which the communist sympathizers and fellow travelers took over in the United States in the 1930s. It must be recognized that the power that these energetic left-wingers exercised was never their own power or communist power, but was ultimately the power of the international financial coterie. And once the anger and suspicions of the American people were aroused, as they were by 1950, it was a fairly simple matter to get rid of the Red sympathizers. This, of course, raises the question of just who is using whom. It is always assumed that it is the communists who dupe others into doing their work. In most cases, this is undoubtedly true. However, it strains credulity to believe that men who are the world's best businessmen and bankers, on the one hand, can be perennial pigeons in dealing with communists on the other. Clearly, there are insiders manipulating both ends of the show. The Rees Committee attempted to investigate this matter. Norman Dodd, chief investigator for the committee, was told by the then president of the Ford Foundation that the purpose of his foundation quote, was to so alter American society that it could be comfortably merged with most of the Soviet Union, unquote. Dodd was then told that this was being done on orders from the White House. Quigley says of the Reese Committee's investigation of tax-exempt foundations, quote, it soon became clear that people of immense wealth would be unhappy if the investigation went too far, and the most respected newspapers in the country, closely allied with these men of wealth, would not get excited enough about any revelations to make the publicity worthwhile in terms of votes or campaign contributions. An interesting report showing the left-wing associations of the interlocking nexus of tax-exempt foundations was issued in 1954 rather quietly. Dodd maintains that when the investigation began probing into the so-called legitimate world, which is the real nerve center of the communist movement, the investigation was quashed. René Wormser, counsel for the Reese Committee, states in his book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, Mr. Congressman Wayne Hayes, an Ohio Democrat who, while serving on the Reese Committee, did everything possible to prevent orderly and coherent hearings, told us one day that the White House had been in touch with him and asked him if he would cooperate to kill the committee. The man in the White House at that time was Dwight Eisenhower, a member of the CFR, who named 6 members of the CFR to his cabinet, as well as naming no less than 12 members of the CFR to the rank of undersecretary. The answer to the question of who is using whom is at least partially answered by Professor Quigley, who reveals the following amazing information about the CFR Morgan manipulation of the left. Quote, more than 50 years ago, the Morgan firm decided to infiltrate the left-wing political movements in the United States. This was relatively easy to do, since these groups were starved for funds and eager for a voice to reach the people. Wall Street supplied both. The purpose was not to destroy, dominate, or take over, but was really threefold. To keep informed about the thinking of left-wing or liberal groups, to provide them with a mouthpiece so they could blow off steam, and to have a final veto on their publicity and possibly on their actions if they ever went radical. What is more likely is that these Wall Streeters financed the left because it was promoting the world superstate sought by the Round Table Group. After all, despite the erroneous publicity about wealthy right-wing millionaires, there has been no corresponding financing of constitutional conservatives by these elements. Quigley cites the alliance between Wall Street and the left in creating New Republic magazine, which was organized by a Morgan associate and financed by an heiress to the Standard Oil Trust. He writes, and I quote, the original purpose for establishing the paper was to provide an outlet for the progressive left and to guide it quietly in an Anglophile direction. This latter task was entrusted to a young man only 4 years out of Harvard, where he helped found the Intercollegiate Socialist Society, but already a member of the mysterious Round Table Group, which has played a major role in directing England's foreign policy since its formal establishment in 1901. The young man was Walter Lippmann, described by Carol Quigley as the authentic voice of the Eastern establishment. The New Republic was founded by Morgan, agent, Willard Strait, Herbert Crowley, the first editor of the magazine and a naive liberal, who accidentally stumbled into 72 officially cited Communist fronts or activities, makes perfectly clear in his official biography of Strait that the latter was in no sense a liberal or a progressive, but was indeed a typical international banker, and that the New Republic was simply a medium for advancing certain designs of such international bankers, notably to blunt the isolationism and anti-British sentiments. Reader's Digest senior editor Eugene Lyons, in his book The Red Decade, extensively chronicles the services done for Soviet Russia by the insider-controlled New Republic. Lyons writes, and I quote, the American liberal aberration had its house organ, the New Republic, which led all the rest in avid and undiscriminating acceptance of the myth of Stalin's utopia. What did serving as Stalin's press agent have to do with advancing certain designs of such international bankers? What indeed? Unless it is promoting the interests of the CFR's goal of world government. The New Republic has been enormously influential among American liberals who do not realize they are tools being used for ulterior purposes. William F. Buckley, Jr. says he began National Review to serve as a right-wing New Republic, but has succeeded only in producing the world's most effective cure for insomnia while attacking anti-communist activists. In fact, the editors of New Republic and the National Review have arranged a deal whereby one may now receive both magazines at the same time for a reduced package rate. Mr. Buckley, whose TV program is carried over CFR-controlled stations and whose column appears in such CFR organs as the New York Post, owned by Jacob Schiff's granddaughter Dorothy, never mentions the CFR. In his syndicated column shortly after the election of Richard Nixon, Buckley went so far as to give his seal of approval to the appointment of Nelson Rockefeller, CFR, as Secretary of State, calling the man who, along with partner Cyrus Eaton, controls American trade with the Red Bloc an anti-communist. Mr. Buckley pretends the enemy is simply liberal philosophy and ideology. He has become the liberal establishment's house conservative, a respectable and responsible adversary, one who never, ever whispers about conspiracy. The Roundtable Group, using Morgan money, has at the same time used both of our political parties and the communists for its own purposes. Quigley reveals, and I quote, "The associations between Wall Street and the left are really survivals of the associations between the Morgan Bank and the left. To Morgan, all political parties were simply organizations to be used, and the firm always was careful to keep a foot in all camps. Morgan himself, Dwight Morrow, CFR, and other partners, were allied with Republicans. Russell C. Leffingwell, CFR, was allied with the Democrats, and Thomas W. Lamont, CFR, was allied with the left." According to Quigley, the Lamont family was the chief link between Wall Street and the communists, although Thomas Lamont, Morgan's partner, was active in Republican presidential politics. As Phyllis Schlafly noted in A Choice Not an Echo, among the most influential kingmakers who profess to be Republicans is the Morgan Banking Group headed by Thomas J. Lamont, Jr., son of the Thomas J. Lamont who masterminded Wilkie's nomination. The Lamonts were also avid supporters of Eisenhower and helped finance Saturday Review and the New York Post. Quigley states that the chief evidence against the Lamonts can be found in the files of HUAC, which show Tom Lamont, his wife Flora, and his son Corliss as sponsors and financial angels to almost a score of extreme left organizations, including the Communist Party itself. During this whole period of over two decades, Corliss Lamont, with the full support of his parents, was one of the chief figures in fellow traveler circles and one of the chief spokesmen for the Soviet point of view. Corliss Lamont, a member of CFR-related groups such as the American Association for the United Nations and the Foreign Policy Association, was named by the House Special Committee on Un-American Activities as probably the most persistent propagandist for the Soviet Union to be found anywhere in the United States. In The Bolshevik Invasion of the West, Louis Boudin's former editor of the Communist Daily Worker, turned anti-communists, writes of the current state of this Wall Street-Moscow axis, and makes the following observation. Quote, "It is the communists in the United States themselves who continue to attest to the progress of the Soviet line, reporting continuous improvement of relations with the Rockefeller-Morgan interest in Wall Street. Right in the midst of the war in Southeast Asia, we are informed that these financial giants push forward their program of help to the Soviet dictatorship." The Worker, July 11, 1965, comes forward with this touching tribute to the House of Morgan's affection for the Sino-Soviet cause. Quote, "The ironical result is that big businessmen are generally more progressive than big labor leaders. It is Thomas Gates, CFR, chairman of the Board of Morgan Guarantee Trust Company, who advocates reconsideration of our China policy, not George Meany. It is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that would explore means of expanding East-West trade, not the AFL-CIO. The Worker of August 30th, 1964 contained this statement from Comrade Victor Perlo. "The change in the balance of world forces towards socialism and nationalism has impelled the more sensible and knowledgeable of the Wall Streeters to move towards limited accommodations with the USSR. Clearly, the Chicago Tribune's editorial on the CFR of December 9, 1950 still applies. Quote, "The members of the Council on Foreign Relations are persons of more than average influence in the community. They have used the prestige that their wealth, their social position, and their education have given them to lead their country toward bankruptcy and military debacle. They should look at their hands. There is blood on them, the dried blood of the last war and the fresh blood of the present one, that was the Korean War." It goes without saying that the CFR's hands are now bloody also with the gore of 150,000 Americans in Vietnam, as the Council has succeeded in promoting as American policy the shipment of American aid and trade to the European arsenal of the Viet Cong, killing our sons in the field. Today, the CFR remains active in working towards its final goal of a government of all the world, a government which the insiders and their allies will control. And they don't even try to hide it. Study number 7, published by the CFR on November 25, 1959, openly advocates building a new international order which must be responsive to world aspirations for peace and for social and economic change, an international order including states labeling themselves as socialist or communist. To accomplish this, the CFR says we must gradually increase the authority of the UN. As part of this effort, the Council on Foreign Relations advocates secret negotiations with the communists as part of disarmament. Quote, "The U.S. should explore Soviet proposals for complete or partial disarmament. Efforts to resolve political conflicts with communist powers should occur simultaneously with, not prior to, disarmament negotiations. Negotiate on these problems, perhaps directly with the USSR, in secret." President Kennedy responded by appointing the chairman of the board of CFR, John J. McCloy, formerly of the Rockefeller Chase Manhattan Bank, to head the U.S. Disarmament Agency. The CFR, in study number 7, also advocates a more ambitious, longer-term foreign aid program, which would avoid making aid contingent upon political commitments to the West. In addition, it recommends recognition of Red China and greatly expanded trade with the communists supplying the Viet Cong. An endless interlock is maintained by the CFR with the major foundations, the Foreign Policy Association, World Affairs Council, the Committee for Economic Development, Business Advisory Council, Institute for American Strategy, Commission on National Goals, American Assembly, National Planning Association, and Americans for Democratic Action. On the international level, the CFR is heavily interlocked with the Bilderbergers, the English-speaking Union, the Pilgrim Society, and with the parent organization, the Round Table. The Council has completely dominated the cabinet and chief advisory posts of the Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson administrations. President Nixon, a former CFR member, has appointed or retained the following members of CFR to high posts in his administration: Henry A. Kissinger, Chief Foreign Policy Advisor, a paid member of the staff of CFR; Henry Cabot Lodge, Chief Negotiator in Paris; Charles Yost, Ambassador to the United Nations, a paid member of the staff of CFR; Arthur Burns, Consulate to the President; Harlan Cleveland, U.S. Ambassador to NATO; George Ball, Foreign Policy Consultant to the State Department; Robert Murphy, Special Consultant on International Affairs; Robert F. Peterson, Counselor and Executive Secretary of the Department of State; Alan Pfeiffer, Consultant to the President on Educational Finance; Dr. Paul McCracken, Chief Economic Aide; Ellsworth Bunker, U.S. Ambassador to Saigon; General Andrew J. Goodpaster, Chief Military Policy Advisor; Dr. Glenn T. Seaborg, Chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission; Joseph J. Sisko, Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East and South Asia; Jacob Beam, Ambassador to the Soviet Union; and Gerald Smith, Director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. Administrations, both Democratic and Republican, come and go, but the CFR lingers on. This is why the more things seem to change, the more they remain the same. The fix is in at the top, where the same coterie of insiders, bent on control of the world, runs the show.